Life is good. Life is good. Life is fine. Life is fine. Life is everything. We loathe it so unkind. They say death is cruel.
Death is cruel.
But death unwinds.
Death unwinds.
It comes naturally to all. Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our roundtable panel for this Wednesday, the 12th of September. Really nice to have you all with us this morning, and we got a great group, and we're very excited to talk about the news of the day with you. We welcome your letters, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to have you join in and share your thoughts with us, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce our stellar panel to you this morning. Our good friend Terry Gibson is here. He is a SUNY New Paltz communications professor, and good morning, former state senator. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me today.
It's good to have you. Very nice to have you on the program. Terry is now back teaching, so Wednesday will be his regular slot, so we're glad to have you here. And
looking forward to it.
Good stuff. Our other Wednesday regular, of course, is
the magnificent
Jen Smith.
Jen Smith, hello.
From the Berkshire Eagle, and she's a terrific reporter, a beat reporter, but also does a lot on the education front and any other story that there is to cover.
That's how we roll in the newsroom.
That's right. In any newsroom, but especially these days, you do whatever.
Yes, you do.
Jen Smith is with us. We are thrilled. We throw out a bunch of dates and say, oh, please, when can you come? And Fran Berman gives us dates, and then we put them in the calendar and we await her arrival. Fran Berman is the Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor.
Whoa.
In computer science at RPI, otherwise known as Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Good morning, Fran Berman.
How you are know you? Who he
Good
was?
Morning.
You know who he was?
Yeah.
Who was he?
He was a guy who endowed a chair at RPI.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you do for a living?
Geeks on the radio, I'm just telling you.
Does he, do you think he minds if I skate, because it's Edward P. Hamilton, do you think he's, like, it's okay if I just call him Ed? or should I do the full name?
You would have to ask him.
Okay, all right. Yeah. I'll do the full name until I hear otherwise. All right.
But hi, everybody.
Good morning. It's very nice to have you with us.
I'm enjoying being an irregular regular. So.
Well, we love having you. Whenever you're, I know you're all over traveling all over. So it's it's great when you're. How many? Do you know how many days a month you're on the road?
This semester is particularly bizarre. I'm going to spend the whole month of October at Harvard. So, you know, but I'll see you all again in November.
Whoa, and you're spending time with the likes of us?
Well, and for our listeners studying data science and the Internet of Things. So I'll have plenty to say when I get back.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to that as always. All right, let's get to the news of the day and find out what's
thing.
Going. Yeah.
I'm here.
Oh, Jesus. I didn't say hi, Alan. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Oh, just one other thing. So you say, and Alan's with us, and I say, let's all sing Kumbaya. Okay, forget
I don't know how to sing Kumbaya. Yeah. How are you?
I'll lead you. I'm good.
I'm embarrassed now that I forgot. Because, see, yesterday I went to you before I went to, and then I don't know, I was talking to Fran.
I'm not holding it against you. I think it brings a certain amount of levity to the affair.
You, it is. It does, and thank you. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, and we are all set. So let's go to.
It's going to be one of those panels.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those panels. Okay. Right, I'm already forgetting. All right, well. Hurricane Florence is barreling up the coast. We talked about this briefly in the green room prior to everybody coming in. And what is fascinating about this storm, it could be potentially devastating, but it is the imaging is just horrific when you look at it. And but there's also that sense of just awe and wonder. If this thing wasn't going to hit land, you would just look at it and say, my God, that's a really amazing storm. But of course, there is the second part of it, which is what happens if it hits the the Carolinas. So aside from powerful wind, Florence could inundate the Carolinas and Virginia. There are multiple threats. There are multiple hazards. It is roaring across the Atlantic Ocean. 140 mile per hour winds on track to crash into the southeast U.S. coast Friday. A slow to a crawl and a really ominous forecast that could deliver rainfall measured in feet rather than inches. Tropical storm force winds are expected to arrive in southeast North Carolina by Thursday morning. The National Hurricane Center said Tuesday that a life-threatening storm surge is now highly likely along the North Carolina and South Carolina coasts. Government officials have issued evacuation orders covering more than 1.5 million residents there as well in Virginia. I spoke to two family members, a niece and a nephew, who are both have been evacuated and seeking higher ground. And everyone seems to be taking this one very, very seriously.
Likewise, I have a colleague in my newsroom who has a family, and there's 9 people in their household plus pets. And it's a range of ages from, you know, young adult to elderly folks. And that's something that everyone has to be mindful when these things happen, and especially in the Carolinas where there are islands out that way. What happens when the ferries stop and you can't just drive around places? What happens when the flooding will always start first, and then you have all the subsequent issues? And it's, you know, we learned this from last storm season, just how exponentially devastating a storm like this can be, just derailing people's lives, their livelihoods. You can't go to work. And so production slows down, and then you are paying oftentimes for places to relocate. And all the other commodities that you need. And then there are the environmental impacts. So there's a lot to think about and watchdog with this storm.
Yeah, I mean, even how you hear the news, you know, your cell phone runs out of battery and no electricity. How do you handle things like that?
But if you had a WAMC crank radio.
There you go. There you go.
The good
stuff. I have one, by the way. I might even have two.
You should do a promo for us.
Yeah, testimonial.
We'll play it during the fun drive. We're getting kind of sick of my sons.
Yeah. I haven't needed it, fortunately. So.
I was thinking about the science behind this, just for our listeners, in case anyone's interested. So how do they know all this stuff? You know, how do you know where it's going to hit, when it's going to hit?
Well, and how, like the latest, it says it'll be a Category 3.
Right.
So how does it go from a Category 5 to a 3, and what makes that, and how does that work, and what's a category?
So so actually look that up for us, because I thought that the listeners would be interested. You can do that, too, on Wikipedia, my friends. So there's something called, and I think I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Saffir-Simpson Hurricane Wind Scale, and it tells which category it is. So Category 3 is 111 miles per hour and above. Category 4 is 130 miles per hour and above, obviously that interval. And so when it drops below 130, it's going to go to Category 3. What they think is going to be really dangerous about this is it gets really slow when it hits land. Mm. So all of that rain just gets dumped in one place, producing those feet. And for those of you who sort of are interested in sort of the advanced geekdom, how they figure this out is they get all of this data from satellites and buoys and ships
and they send a
buoys,
plane.
B-U-O-O-Y.
Yeah. They send a plane in front.
And radar, yes.
No, I was watching CNN. The guy was talking from the plane in the middle of the hurricane.
Yeah, yeah. So they get all that data. They push it through a supercomputer simulation. And then they make a prediction, which is not a certainty, so it's not always exactly right. But if you wonder, you know, how do they get this model in the first place, they actually compare what happened in this model from previous storms to try to perfect it over
just
time.
Just like the pollsters do.
So, yeah, it's
and they get it wrong also.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because, as Joe just said, how do they do it? But The fact is, it's already made liars out of them in that it's turned to the left. It's going south, which they didn't exactly expect it was going to do when they got on.
Well, not liars, but, you know, your no model is exactly precise.
You're
right?
Exactly.
Especially when you're dealing with Mother Nature.
Yeah.
It's a very good correction. I just have liar on my mind for
some
reason.
Anyway, that was your geek moment for this morning, my
So it's also when they post these warnings of, I mean, when you think, for anyone who has driven the coast, you know just how long it is from Virginia to the tail end of South Carolina. So, I mean, that's a huge area that you're talking about. So that's the target range.
And you might not know exactly where it hits. The interesting thing that I read is that people are more worried about the water than the wind.
Sure.
So, you know, you can stay in place with the wind, but as the water rises, you know, you can really get in trouble.
And then the storm surge, of course,
right.
And then the...
Which is the water.
Water, but then also how that affects inland, too, not just the coastal communities,
so rivers
but inland
overflow,
as well.
And then the water table is already pretty high from these summer rains, which we're getting arguably, you know, because of climate change and all of that. So it all kind of works together.
I know this doesn't work on the radio, but just for our panel, this is the latest modeling from NOAA that the imagery with the... But you look at the storm, and this is all in color, and you can just go to Washington Post on the Florence story, and it's right there. And there's this simulated model. But you look at this thing of Florence moving through the Atlantic Ocean, and it is... So when they say monster, it really... is. And you see that it's just barreling through. The other thing that I will note on this is you have Florence here, and right behind it you have Isaac and Helene, which is a little frightening as well.
And on the opposite coast you have Olive. So
right, yes.
This country is going to, in some way or another, being asked for assistance. And I think that became problematic too when, you know, the president was like, oh, the storm responses that we had last year were great. They were tremendous, whatever. I can't remember exactly the adjective he chose. But and then you look at the latest FEMA report and it says we can do better. Here's exactly where we missed out, what we need to do. That the three storms last year between Harvey, Irma and Maria generated $265 billion worth of damages and affected 4.8 million households. And that was the most number of applicants they've had for FEMA assistance in the past, that equated to what was filed for the past decade. So if that's any indicator of what we can expect for this storm season, because it's just the start of the storm season too.
Right.
And then you hear the latest CBO report of what our national debt is. and this is scary stuff. Do we have enough human resources? Do we have enough finances? Do we have enough capacity and infrastructure and planning to really meet the needs of what's being asked? And this is on top of wildfires. This is on top of poor Hawaii as they're facing another storm. They've also, you know, they're still recovering from the effects of volcano and lava flow. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Well, it's also on top of the hurricane damage that our country has already sustained in recent years. For instance, here in New York, we're still actually recovering from Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Irene, which were similar to these storms in terms of the surge, in terms of how the Hudson River flooded and all the water was pushed up into areas that normally did not experience hurricane effects. And we saw that same kind of thing happen in Houston. We certainly saw it happen in New Orleans. And so what's scary about this type of storm is that it will hit land and then it will travel slowly through the rest of that area, and places that normally don't experience flooding, maybe 50, 60, 70 miles away from the coast, will all of a sudden be underwater. And that's what happened here in New York, and that's what could happen there. And we have to be prepared from that, from an infrastructure point of view. And I think it's clear from past hurricanes that no state and coastal regions in this country is really prepared in terms of the infrastructure that they have in place to deal with this.
Yeah, and to go a little Judith Inc on and everyone too, the environmental impacts of stormwater is really huge. We've had evidence just in non-rainy seasons of the effects of stormwater runoff going from farms like cattle ranching farms and affecting those leafy green crops like lettuces, and that's when you get contamination outbreaks. And right now, farmers farmers, you know, they've lifted individual harvesting laws in the counties in the Carolinas so that farmers can try to harvest as much as they can to save their crops in that area. What they do with them then, I don't know. You know, how do you ship and distribute them? And then you get a lot of public health concerns. So there's a lot of public health and safety, again, you know, medicines, what happens to animals. I know this region received a lot of animals that were abandoned or separated from their families during from Puerto Rico and the USVIs. We're all really affected as a country.
But, you know, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say one thing, and that is, with all of the prediction ability that we have, there are always unforeseen consequences. Mm-hmm. And as the climate gets worse and worse, there is the possibility that we could really have some problems. In my life, everything, of course, as you all know, to great boredom, is Fire Island. And here is Fire Island, a barrier beach between Long Island, right? But lately, the storms on Fire Island have been causing new inlets. So in other words, the bay and the ocean start to get connected. If Fire Island at one point goes under, which it will, then Long Island becomes the beach. And when the hurricanes come, that could be extraordinary. Now, it hasn't happened yet, but it could happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think a really important thing to note in all of these comments is you have these forces going diametrically opposed, sure, away from each other. So you have the ecosystem, mm-hmm, which, you know, we need more and more resources, we need more and more infrastructure, we need more and more help to be able to deal with this. And then you have the climate, which is making us much more vulnerable to these extreme weather events that are going to cause, you know, damage and these catastrophic things. And so these, you know, these two directions are going in opposite directions, mm-hmm, and it's scary.
I was just thinking about how fortunate we are here in New York not to have to deal with this particular hurricane, especially New York City. I mean, they're literally in New York City now about to shut down the L line. If they haven't already done that, they are about to. And they're doing that because of the damage that that line incurred during the last hurricane in New York City. It was literally drowned. And they're just now getting to that. Can you imagine if the city was to have to deal with another hurricane of that force,
right,
which is possible.
It's possible
this season. It could happen.
Sure.
So the money that needs to be invested in repairing that is just not available.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We started off earlier this morning with Flogging Molly and just heard from Yonder Mountain String Band, all artists performing at Fresh Grass at Massamoca. All great stuff. So
right down the road from me.
Yes.
Very
you going?
Yeah.
What was the name,
excellent,
of that first band you mentioned?
The first one was Flogging Molly.
Flogging Molly.
Flogging Molly are
Flogging
great.
Molly, they're great.
Flogging Molly?
Yes.
Flogging. Okay, I just want to make sure I got that right.
Okay. Good old-fashioned Irish flogging.
Yeah, don't mess that up, Terry.
Yeah.
There go any political aspirations right out the window if you screw that up.
Right, yeah. Let's get that correct.
It is, we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. But just real quick, it's massmoca.org. If you want more information on that, but if you want to see the list and find out the music, we've gotten a couple of letters from people who want to know what the stuff is. You can just go to our website. It's wamc.org/roundtable, and we have a playlist there. Now, as for letters, Alan has some. We'll read those, and we'll move on.
And we heard from Tim, who starts his letter appropriately by saying, "Beloved panel, with the American West on fire and Hurricane Florence barreling towards the Carolina coast, Trump is responding to the climate crisis by loosening methane emissions. When will the madness stop?"
Well, I mean, we talked about this yesterday. It does seem to be a great concern, both the UN speaking out on climate change and us being derelict in our duty, meaning the world. And yes, of course, this storm barreling up the coast.
Well, there's nothing surprising if we look at who, you know, the petroleum industry, the oil and gas industry are huge supporters of the Republican Party and Donald Trump. So it's not surprising that he's willing to help them find ways to increase their profit through increasing access to fossil fuels. So elections are the way that we fix this.
Thank you for that. And thank you, Tim, for the very good letter. And then to Janet, who says, Cuomo in Puerto Rico. Cynthia Nixon does not bring up any responsibility Cuomo might have in the failures in the long aftermath of Puerto Rico's hurricane. Why wouldn't she? Well, you know, Janet, I don't hear her all the time. I suspect neither do you. And she may well have said something, but it's possible she hasn't. I don't think there's any conspiracy here. Does anybody else?
Well, I think that there are a lot of voters that have looked at how the governor dealt with the Puerto Rico issue and think that maybe he tried to use it just for political gain.
Well, there's no
question.
And that
the effort that was actually put there maybe wasn't as large as he made it out to be. He has been known to exaggerate things in the past, or more recently, very recently.
Well, he made several trips there, by the way.
He did. So I think it's difficult for his opponent to use this as an election issue because he did make an effort to go there. It's hard to criticize him for that. And I think there are lots of other issues people want to talk about.
Yeah. You know, it's always great. You can say, well, he knew what was good for him. The Puerto Rican constituency in New York is huge. And you go to Puerto Rico or you go to Israel or you go here or there. It's what a good politician does, right?
Right, okay. Right.
And we don't ever – I mean, it's really not appropriate for us to say, what was his motive in going there? The only thing you can say is he went there.
Right.
Okay. And so thank you for that, Janet. And Alex says, coastline building. Every time a hurricane hits our coast, I admit to feeling very little sympathy for the overbuilt beach houses lining the coast, most built on sand dunes that people have zero reason to be living on. They are just obsessed with their spoiled beach culture and must live right on said beach, which is totally insane. I tend to root for their houses, oh boy, to drown. Not the people, of course, but no sympathy for what are usually second homes. That's from Alex. Well, this is what we call a prime example of schadenfreude. You got a big house on the beach. You know, you shouldn't have it there.
Well, also, there are, what about the houses behind the house on the beach and all the people who work in those communities and the people who live there and make their living there and the towns and the settlements?
That's a huge part of their economy, right?
Is
building those houses and having a tourism industry. You know,
that, but some places won't allow it anymore.
Yeah, and I think that has to be mindful too. But, you know, I think that's why. And if you look at I highly recommend reading the FEMA report. I learned a lot last night. Just how interconnected it is and how important it is when you're responding to these disasters that, you know, one of the things FEMA is calling for is more communication with the private sector so that you're prepared to manage resources and evaluate assets and aftermath. Those are huge things to do. And not one agency has the capacity to handle a massive crisis or an environmental disaster alone.
I mean, Jen's right. I mean, to me, the key word is infrastructure. And you need infrastructure to be able to support the roads and the bridges and, you know, the homes and the businesses and whatever. And our infrastructure, it's failing, it's old, it's, you know, insufficient to these new weather disasters.
Yeah, take the L train.
Yeah, take the L train. Yeah. But I think also to Joe's point on this topic is that we do have to acknowledge the fact that there is a real job shortage in this country in terms of good, sustainable jobs. And so many people, vast parts of this country, are left with no choice but to work in the tourism industry, which often happens along coastal regions. And so many people would prefer not to be maybe living on the beach. They would prefer to be able to buy a home inland, but they can't afford it. It doesn't.
Not those people who we know on Fire Island, as Alex says, and other places.
Fire Island might be an exception.
Who are sitting on, beach houses. Supreme beach houses are very popular around the world. I mean, you sit out there and you have your coffee and you watch the waves. Nice. but of course not good for anybody.
And at the end of the day, people are people. I mean, you may not like that they built somewhere, but you don't want people to die.
Yeah, I just get very concerned when we talk about criticizing housing conditions or eliminating housing for people. I get very concerned about that because often people don't have a choice in where they live.
No, they don't. And it does follow an economic model. There's no question about who lives where. Okay, so that was from Alex. And he did, to be fair, Alex, not the people, of course. He said, not the people. He said, before that, I tend to root for their houses to drown. And then he said, not the people, of course. So I just want to make that clear in his favor. Eileen says, comment, good morning. And with all of the drama storming around Trump, did I hear correctly yesterday they chose to take away regulations on oil and gas emissions? Wouldn't you think his advisors would say, let's wait on this? Well, there are a couple of points about this. First of all, since when does he listen to his advisors? And secondly, do they have the ability to, you know, to tell him what to do? We don't think so. There you are. But it's an interesting point. He certainly did. And the methane crisis was quite pronounced yesterday as he made this thing. And MF says, FEMA funds depleted. Good morning, panel. Please discuss the report that the administration diverted $10 million from FEMA to increase ICE detention centers. Yet now we have insufficient funds to deal with disaster relief.
I don't know the numbers on the last part, but in terms of insufficient funds for disaster relief, that's pretty apparent. It is an issue that needs to be addressed. And, you know, I think, again, if you look at the CBO report that came out recently about government spending and about national debt projections, you know, we're not bringing any money with some of the tax reforms that we've had. So we're not making the money, even though we're technically a healthy economy. So where does this revenue come from to handle things like disasters? And a lot of it's very well known that a lot of the money that's being diverted is going into defense systems and not the kind of defense systems that shore up disaster response relief.
Right. That's interesting because I was reading an article yesterday about how the defense money is going into sort of big, giant defense systems rather than really agile, small defense systems that are much better able to deal with the kind of problems that we're having now, including cybersecurity, for example.
Right. Absolutely. And one of the things we should all mention, because we haven't mentioned it yet, is the gigantic war games that are going on, not here, but with the Chinese and the Russians getting together for the largest war games that have ever happened. Mm-hmm. Now, there's got to be a good reason they're doing that. In some way, it has to be reflective of what they're thinking about the current administration in Washington.
Right. So you're spending more and you're not spending smart, and both of those are really, really difficult challenges.
Sure. You know, friends, the first hydrogen bomb that gets sailed somewhere, you can have all the backup in the world, more and more and more hydrogen bombs. But one hydrogen bomb is going to knock out New York.
Well, it's probably also important to point out that we used to know how to do both. We used to know how to have a strong military and also how to have strong infrastructure and continue to try to improve it at the same time. And somehow our elected officials have slowly forgotten how to do that or just don't want to do that. So it is possible, and hopefully we can remember how to do it again soon.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll return. We have many more issues to talk about. We'll do that and welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Postponing all their hurt in their bait in their breath, waiting on a change. That's basically the new age. Everyone sleeps.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Fran Berman, Jen Smith, and Terry Gibson join us this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Quick reminder, keep the letters short. Don't include links. Don't use abbreviations. And for God's sakes, proofread them before you send them so we actually know what you're trying to say, because sometimes we don't. Simple as that. All right, let's move on to some other stuff, and we'll talk about what else is going on in the world. And we begin with, oh, wait, no, we don't begin, but we continue. So is Paul Manafort in talks? Is Paul Manafort in talks with prosecutors about a possible plea? Yes, say people familiar with the discussions.
If he has a brain in his head.
Days before in-person jury selection is set to begin in his second trial, President Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort is in talks with the special counsel's office about a possible plea deal, according to two people with knowledge of the discussions. The people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe the conversations cautioned that the negotiations may not result in a deal with special counsel Robert Mueller, who is prosecuting Manafort for alleged money laundering and lobbying violations. But the discussions indicate a possible shift in strategy for Manafort, who earlier this year chose to go to trial in Virginia, only to be convicted last month in Alexandria federal court on 8 counts of bank and tax fraud.
Okay, let's put ourselves in his place. Now, you've been convicted on enough counts, with 8, I believe, left that they could retry you on, and another trial that you're going forward to.
Correct.
And clearly, you have the potential for spending the rest of your life in prison already without anything else. End of, you know, as we say around here, deal done and no more discussion. You know, just take the deal, because that's the only hope you have now.
It seems like a big game of chicken, right? Like, is he going to give in, and is he going to, you know, hold out for that pardon, or is, you know, is he going to look at a deal? What that means? I mean, it's exponentially costly if Trump goes through this.
But Trump doesn't dare give him a pardon now. He just doesn't dare give him a pardon.
Well, I wouldn't put anything beyond him. But I think what's different about this trial is that it seems to, and I think this must have some bearing on his decision-making process, this trial, more than the first one, seems to involve more people from Russia, more people from the Ukraine that he had associations with that were a part of this alleged cover-up about how he was laundering money in various political schemes, some of which definitely involved the Trump campaign. And I think there may be a real concern about him speaking on behalf of what actually happened in these transactions in a way that he hasn't done before. That's certainly going to be troubling to our president right now. And it certainly has to be weighing heavily into the plea deal.
And he doesn't have a lot of time, which is interesting, right? Because this trial is set to open on Monday. You know, opening statements, I think, are set to start on the 24th. So what happens in the next couple of days? What do we think will come out? Because I don't know, what can change mid-trial?
No.
You can't take a deal before the trial starts, right?
Yeah, you can take a deal before
trial. I mean, during a trial.
Look, you can take a deal before the trial, you can take a deal during the trial, and you can certainly take a deal after the trial is over.
I mean, but when is wise?
Work. Well, I mean, he has to have determined now that Trump is not going to pardon him, in which case, if he wants to see the outside of a prison cell for a long, long time, he's got to make a deal.
Well, but isn't he already going to prison with the first trial?
Yeah, he's going to prison. But if Trump pardons him, that's a whole other deal. But if he deals now with the prosecutor and gives him what he wants, which is clear, they have been leaning on him to get him to, you know, to talk about Trump. If he does that, maybe he'll spend 5 years in prison as opposed to the rest of his life.
Well, this trial in many ways is much more significant. And if you the article talks about the list of possible people that they will be bringing forward to testify against Manafort, that the government will be bringing forth. And on that list, as it mentions in the article, are 23 Ukrainian and 4 European politicians.
knowing that this entire case and the previous one involves money laundering between the United States and Russia, and between Paul Manafort and Russia, between possibly the Trump campaign and Russia, that's very disconcerting that 23 politicians from the Ukraine could possibly be called to testify against you.
Yeah, but he's still going to jail for the rest of his life from the first trial. That's why the question of pardon, or as Cuomo used to say in the after the fact, post hoc procta hoc, would come, you know, it would make sense for him to use what he has now, because if he's found guilty and he does nothing, he's going to spend every waking moment in prison.
He clearly knows a lot of stuff that he has not shared yet. And
well, they know he does.
Well, and the prosecution says that as well, and when they say they're planning to introduce all this new evidence, which I'm curious about, like, what is that? What haven't we seen? You know, we saw what came out in this last trial, so what are we missing? You know, what could we see in this new trial that we don't already know about?
So what are you telling us? Are you telling us I, Jen, would prefer that he went to trial and told us
not necessarily, but I still think, like, you know, what is that information?
Well, and who would it implicate?
Exactly.
Well, at the bare minimum, we are going to see one of the most well-experienced, most high-priced United States political consultants engaging in some type of political consulting work with one of our largest enemies, Russia. And I mean, the bare minimum, that already exists. We know that happened. So it only gets worse from there.
It doesn't look good for this guy either way around. I mean, it's the point that, you know, the sidebar news was that his daughter is already changing her last name. There's a street named after his father in his hometown, and they're making clear that it's Paul Manafort Sr. and not this Paul Manafort. Yeah, people are already just separating from him. So, I mean, what does he have left?
Put another way, we would rather not be him.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
Okay, but here's an interesting letter from somebody in North Carolina who listens to us in North Carolina.
Oh, God, love you.
Wow, good luck to you.
Hello, all. I live just outside Raleigh. Last night, I took out our crank radio and tested it.
Oh, my gosh.
Worked like a champ.
Yay.
Great for charging phones and weather information, and that's Steve. Love
thank
that
you.
Letter.
Thank
that's
you, Steve, and be
great.
Safe.
Yeah,
there's your commercial right there.
What? Okay, and then Sarah said, money taken from the FEMA budget. Does the panel know that, as reported on Rachel Maddow last night, the Trump administration transferred $10 million from the FEMA budget to ICE for the building of internment camps for immigrant families? I suppose the Trump administration considers that when hurricane emergency comes, they can ask for appropriations for FEMA. This is to get around requesting money for imprisoning families, parentheses, that opposed to the last administration's method of ankle bands and release until cases are heard. And that's from Sarah.
I saw that story, and it caught my attention, too. And it is very disturbing that money that's supposed to be used to relieve victims of natural disasters is now being used for ways we don't know to deal with housing people that are being held by ICE. What we don't know is how the money is being used in this ICE situation. Is it really being used to help provide housing? Or are the companies, the private corporations that are involved in building these large housing structures really gouging the U.S. government and gouging Donald Trump and asking for really more than they should be asking for? The whole idea is just very disturbing, and I'm really glad that they wrote in about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and while we're on the subject, but not quite on the subject, as usual, is the idea that yesterday while watching the news, I saw a rather in-depth story about how they're using facial recognition in airports. 16 airports are the pilot projects. But when they put up the entire congressional delegation, they found that it made all kinds of mistakes, including calling all of the congressmen crooks. Or many of these congressmen,
was a mistake?
Criminals. Sure. Well, you know, you took the words right out of my mouth.
Intuitive or a mistake? I'm sorry.
And they found that people of color in the congressional delegation were far more likely to be rejected by the facial recognition, not knowing who they were. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting story in it by itself. I say that
AI bias.
I only say that because Rosemary's not here, and this would be
These first of all, these technologies are not perfect. Second of all, these technologies do have bias, and that's a really important thing to remember because, humans write the code, and humans provide the learning sets for these technologies that learn.
And, I love it when you talk this way.
Well,
I could hear it forever.
for those of you that remember, Microsoft did a chat bot called Tay, which became a Nazi in 16 hours because of the things it learned from people talking to it. So these technologies need ethical systems, both in their development and in the ecosystem surrounding them.
Fran, I'm so fascinated by what you just said about the Nazi. Could you explain that one to us?
Okay, so it developed a chatbot, and the chatbot was supposed to emulate a 19-year-old young woman. And, you know, people would chat with it, and it would learn from what people said to it and, you know, provide responses to it. And, you know, this is a great scientific experiment. But over 16 hours, because of the people that talked with it and the kinds of things it learned, it actually got some very, very biased feedback and learned itself to basically be a Nazi. And then Microsoft pulled it. We learned a lot about AI, but not in a necessarily good way. And if you put these things out unregulated, without thoughtfulness about ethics, you know, you can really get into trouble. And the facial recognition algorithms can have some of those same problems. Mm.
Terrific.
One more, and then we have to go.
Here we go. Ryan writes, methane conversation. Good morning. While it's deplorable that Trump would lift methane restrictions, at what point does it fall back on the consumer to push back against companies that wish to pollute in such detrimental ways? Voting can help set regulations, but we are not powerless when it comes to putting pressure on companies who pollute. Are we not? And that's from Ryan.
Well, we are not powerless. We have the right to vote, which most of us, as studies show, continue not to use. Also, there's an economic issue here that the oil and gas company continues to use their lobbying power to make it very difficult to purchase anything that doesn't use fossil fuels. For instance, if you try to go out and buy an electric car, you find that it may often be inaccessible or unaffordable in many states. Many states have regulations against them. These are the kind of things that make it difficult for us to fight back. So elections continue to be the easiest thing we could do to change these dynamics, and more people hopefully will understand that we've got to participate.
Mm-hmm. I so agree with this. I think I say this every time I'm on the radio, which is, you know, the absolute best thing our listeners can do is vote. Vote your conscience, vote in an informed way, show up. You know, if we don't show up, it's not happening.
It's one of the reasons I wear my sticker that they gave me on the election in Great Barrington. Said I voted.
Yeah, Alan's wearing an I voted sticker today.
And I used transportation for that example, but you could also use the same example in terms of just energy generation. Solar panels, wind panels, geothermal, all of that continues to be regulated in such a way that makes it difficult for the average person to get access to that more affordable, clean, green energy. And that's all because legislators make it that way.
Or Terry, the information. In other words, we can go and vote. I have no idea who the tree warden in Great Barrington is when I have to choose between. I think I used to have to do that in Alford. I'm not sure.
Vote for the tree warden?
Yeah. The local conservation commission.
I have no idea. So I end up looking for where they live, you know, what street they live on, that kind of thing, as opposed to most people. I mean, I think that's one of the big problems. Don't know enough about any of it.
Okay, well, Alan, what's the job of a tree warden?
I have no idea.
Well, you know, it actually...
Jen knows, don't you?
I've done a lot of stories on horticulture and arboriculture, and with all our borders right now, one of the big issues is dealing with invasive species like the emerald ash borer. They're the folks that go out and inspect the trees, they inspect the tree health, and how it plays out in our ecosystem. So they're
that's
important
a political
folks.
Position. Like, what is the debate between
Republican?
Yeah, what's the debate between
experience? I don't know, but there are. I will say there are, in all seriousness, there are a lot of regulations that you do have to be aware of and follow. So you can't just walk in and be like, I love trees. You really have to know about the systems as well.
All right, we will pause there and have that. Try to figure that out in our brains, and we'll be back after this break.
Rain is tapping on my window pane, keeping me awake well past two. I can't seem to shake what the demons say, and I got those damn New England blues. Got those
those damn New England blues. Got those damn New England blues. For 500 days I called you mine, 100 years have passed since then. You broke my heart on the borderline, and I swore never be a fool again. Swore never be a fool again. Swore never be a fool again.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 12th of September. Alan Chartok is here, Fran Berman, Jen Smith, and Terry Gibson, and we include your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll start there and then move on to other stuff.
Okay, Joe. And Ellen says, good morning, truth tellers.
Good morning. Mm.
There you go. Claiming his response to helping Puerto Rico post-hurricane an incredible unsung success, Trump has moved $10 million from the FEMA fund to ISIS. Apparently, immigrants are more of a threat than hurricanes. And this is what you meant, Joe, when you said, make sure you read your letters.
Yeah,
I don't think he moved them to ISIS. That's a little different. But thank you, Ellen. That's
great.
That'll
be a whole other story.
And Sean says, panel, we have some very contested primaries tomorrow, and you're spending the morning talking about a hurricane that will barely reach New York. Seriously.
Oh, my God.
One of the things I thought about when I said we're very lucky not to have this hurricane hit was that we do have, as they said, very important primaries tomorrow in this state. We have the governor and the AG, and many state Senate assembly races are up. The people that will be chosen to run on the Democratic line are in the hands of the voters as of right now. And I just want to encourage everyone to understand how important this is and to come out and vote.
And one of the one of the most important parts of this is really contested is the AG race, attorney general race, because there are many people, and I think the New York Times has made this point, who truly believe that we need an AG who will keep an eye on the governor. And one of the things that Letitia James, who is the leading candidate, has going against her is that she has the full-throated support of Andrew Cuomo, and which turned out in the beginning was supposed to be a very good thing for her, but now turns out not to be so good because people are saying, but who's going to watch the fox in the henhouse?
Yeah, well, what I have really enjoyed about this whole primary aspect, especially in the governor's and the AG race and even some of the state Senate and assembly races, is that some very talented, very brave, very honest, very good people have stepped forward to really challenge the status quo. And it's a historic opportunity for the voters to really have real choices about
example,
who represents them.
For example, name names.
Well, there's many. I mean, there's many. You have Zephyr Teachout running for Attorney General.
I knew you were going to say
that. Who is independent, who has promised to investigate the governor and investigate Donald Trump and has proven her independence from all elected officials and all parties. Well, look, in the governor's race, you have Cynthia Nixon, who is a woman who has stepped forward to challenge what seems to be an insurmountable challenge. But yet you have to give her credit for having the guts to stand up and do this. And she deserves a lot of credit. And I hope that people will give her serious consideration as they go out and decide who is going to run. Because having served as state government myself, I can tell you this, regardless of what party you're in, we're at a time right now in this state where if we do not get new leadership at all levels of government, it's not realistic to expect any real significant change.
You know, I was reading a column in the, I hate to say it, New York Post this morning by a man named Goodwin, who I don't generally like to listen to. But he talked about, you know, when Ed Koch was opposing Cuomo and the sign had been put on the Grand Central Parkway, which was vote for Cuomo, not the homo. That was a well-known thing, and Ed Koch eventually sort of forgave him, but quote never forgot what they had done. And there was talk of private detectives trying to find out that the Cuomo people had hired, trying to find out who Ed Koch's gay lover, might be. So, and then we see Cuomo surrounded by these guys who are going to jail, his closest advisors, who are not only selling for themselves, but getting people to contribute to the campaign on pay to play. And yet he's ahead by 40 points.
Oh, look, on more realistic issues here, we have a housing crisis, we have an economic crisis, we have a jobs crisis, we have a transportation crisis, we have many environmental crises that are not being dealt with in this state. So if you want people to deal with these things in a way that is to your liking, then we need new people to do it. And you have choices this time. You can have a new governor. You can have a new attorney general. You can have a new state senator. You can have a new assembly member. And it is worth your while to spend time investigating who your choices are and pick the one that you think best represents you, because they have the power to make things much, much better for you and your families.
All right.
Back
next letter.
Sean says,
vote tomorrow.
Yeah. Sean says, we have some very contested primaries tomorrow. Oh, yeah, he said that, and we read it. And thank you, Sean, for giving us that opportunity. And Bobby says, GOP bad for environment and public health. Does the panel know of any Republicans with strong voting record of protecting the environment? As far as I know, the GOP is bad for public health, and now with the era of Trump, bad for public safety. Well, certainly in the old days, there were the Rockefeller Republicans, and they were very pro-environment. And you know, they did what they had to do, and Nelson Rockefeller was an extraordinary campaigner on that subject.
But, well, I don't know his political views, but I know that the candidate for science advisor for the United States is a guy from Oklahoma who is the real deal. He is he understands about climate. He's tracked hurricanes. He is a really great scientist.
So, Fran, when you say the candidate,
Kelvin Drogemeyer.
When you say the candidate, does that mean he hasn't been chosen?
Well, I'm not sure what the process is. He has been, I guess, nominated. I guess he must go through. Well, you guys probably.
No, here.
No, he's pointing you to speak into the microphone.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure what the process is, but he has been named to be. The science advisor of the, maybe our readers do and help me with this.
Okay.
But he's named to be the science advisor of the U.S. He's the real deal.
Okay. And let's go to Kathleen. Storm damage. Hi, panel. Not sure you've mentioned this regard to storm damage. One of the very first regulations that Trump threw out when he came to the White House was the new Obama regs that required businesses and residents who are susceptible to repeated storm damage to rebuild to a much stricter construction code. Throwing those regs out will no doubt translate to JQ Public having ever higher insurance bills, and the shoreline folks can still rebuild over and over again with only the flood and storm insurance costs. Keep up the great work, from Kathleen. And Janet says, I apologize, I missed the cybersecurity's professor's name.
Fran Berman.
Fran Berman. Mm-hmm. But could you comment on the report of ISPs? Verizon's and Comcast already shown to be throttling content now that net neutrality is gone. I have not backsourced this yet for factuality.
Yeah, I haven't seen that report yet, but that was something that we were all afraid of, that once net neutrality is gone, you know, it becomes a marketplace and not a free space.
But what is the claim here? I'm sorry, I'm so naive. Tell me what is meant when, say, by throttling content now. What is throttling content?
It's kind of like making a highway into a toll road. Mm-hmm. So those who can pay enjoy a better service and enjoy better aspects of that. Those who can't cannot enjoy that. And
sure.
If you think about the internet as being kind of the communication fabric of the modern age, allowing some people to use it more effectively and other people not to is really a problem. And net neutrality is really all about that differentiality.
Now, can the states do net neutrality?
So the interesting thing is, that's a great question. I feel like you set me up, Alan. Many of the states, including California, are actually making rules so that they will advantage vendors who do net neutrality. So if you are a vendor and they're looking for some sort of services from you and you don't provide net neutrality, you will not be advantaged in that process. So it's a way of kind of getting around the lack of federal net neutrality rules to kind of make that happen within your state.
All the more reason why state government really does matter.
Right.
State government elections really do matter, because when the federal government fails us, we can look to the state for help.
Well, and you look at all these places, you know, in the digital world where states are really making inroads where the federal government has not. California, you have a right to data privacy. That's part of the state constitution. I believe it's Vermont where they just put in a law about data brokers and transparency, so people can't sell your data except in circumstances that are more advantageous to you. So when states do that, it really puts pressure. Now, you know, the bad thing is if each state has a different approach, you know, it would be better to have a consistent federal approach. But in the absence of a consistent federal approach, you know, these are very good things, well, in my opinion.
We have a president now that really does embrace, and a Republican Party that really embraces handing power back to the states, not just on issues related to communications, but on issues related to healthcare, issues related to transportation, issues related to gun safety. And it is doing exactly what you said. It's creating a situation that is a hodgepodge of laws that vary from border to border. It's not ultimately effective as it could be if the federal government would take the responsibility that they're elected to do.
So if you want to drive a self-driving car from New York to California, you will go through so many different jurisdictions and laws. Well, I guess you don't drive, you sit in a self-driving car. You go through so many jurisdictions and laws governing those cars, and in some states there's nothing at all. I mean, it's kind of a crazy hodgepodge, just like you said.
Someone should do that and really document that, because that's very interesting. You would encounter that wide variety of state laws we're talking about.
You would,
and you could document it. Let's do that.
Okay. Terry and I are leaving this morning.
I can't wait to get in the car in the morning at 3:30 in the morning and say, take me to Albany. That would be great.
No.
Okay. Ryan says, methane conversion. While it is deplorable that Trump would lift methane restrictions, at what point does it fall back on the consumer to push back against companies that wish to pollute?
I think it's the same.
Oh, we read that already.
Yep.
Same letter?
I think so.
Boy, I'm so sorry.
It was worth repeating.
Okay. I don't know whether these, now you've got me gun shy. this does seem very familiar. Does the panel know that it's reported on Rachel Maddow?
I think we reached a repeat stack.
Yeah. I don't know what happened here.
I think they missed their trip to the recycle.
What the heck?
All right. Thank you very much. So we have just a few minutes, but we do have time for another topic, and we will do that right now. Let me suggest that we... Well, we've been talking a lot about campaigns. We touched on this, but I just want to talk more about it because I find it so fascinating, and I like it. the whole Ted Cruz challenge. This is really interesting. So his challenger is doing quite well, thank you very much. In Texas, this guy is...
And his name is Beto O'Rourke.
Beto O'Rourke. He's an El Paso congressman. He's been making the talk show rounds. He's been outraising Mr. Cruz. He has really been, they say, single-handedly reviving the long-suffering spirits of Texas Democrats. He not only is... yes, it's one of the reddest states in the country, but not only is he raising money in his district, but he's going throughout the state and raising money for other other candidates as well.
And people are sending, and Joe, people are sending him money from all over the country.
Yeah. All over the country.
Because Cruz is seen as not a nice guy. Now, when they talk about Cruz and what his problems are, the psychologists and others are saying people don't like him. He's not a nice...
Likeability factor.
He's not a nice man. And all of a sudden, you see him being an aw shucks guy on the radio, on the television. He's going all around and being a nice guy. So is it too late?
There's no comparison. If you have not seen Beto O'Rourke on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter and some of his videos, I encourage you to do it. This guy is incredible. I have never seen a candidate work so incredibly hard and go so many places and talk to so many people and do it with such enthusiasm. It's really an amazing...
Well, they think he can win, you know.
I sure hope so.
He does, and I hate comparisons like this, so I apologize in advance. But there is a Kennedy-esque quality to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I know I'm not original in saying that, but there is a Kennedy-esque quality to the guy.
The words just flow from his mouth in ways that anybody running for office would love to be able to do. And it just seems to be this fountain that never ends. There's several videos out there, one about where he talks about his feelings about people kneeling on the national anthem, which I think is received more views than President Obama's inaugural speech. I mean, they're just captivating. And the crowds that go to his rallies are extremely diverse, ethnically and every way you can possibly imagine. And for Texas, that's pretty phenomenal.
Sure. But I think the big question, though, is he's getting a lot of national media attention. Right. How does it play out in Texas?
Money.
So you have, and which is, you know, definitely Republicans, they show up to the polls. So you've got 15 million voters. The pollsters say that fewer than 40% of these people are expected to turn out into the polls and actually cast their votes for a candidate. And I think what will be interesting is, you know, some people still don't know who in Texas, some people still don't know who O'Rourke is. And so I think that's something. Yes, he's getting a lot of this outside attention, but I think that'll matter. And I think when we look at some of the midterms that have already taken place, it really came down to how the candidates were talking about the issues. But it has to be issues that are relevant to the state in which they're going to be representing. And if you look at the big issues in Texas right now, it's border, it's immigration, which, you know, obviously these two candidates vary quite a bit on, and then followed by education, healthcare, and yes, hurricane issues are still something as Texas is still reeling from Harvey.
Yeah, and yet, Jen, the polls are showing this to be a real horse race. Very close.
They're kind of in the 40%, you know, realm, right?
But does anybody know whether the Democrats have gone into the highest gear about the get out the vote? I mean, that seems to me like
that's a great point. We still have a long time, politically speaking.
And I think you know, this election is going to be one, like all of them, it's really going to reflect on how well or not well the Democratic Party has gone about organizing and getting out the vote, which we know they haven't done such a good job of in the past.
Right.
So a lot of people don't realize that most of Texas' major cities are Democratic now, but outside the city in the suburbs, the numbers are very Republican. So there is a place for the Democratic Party in Texas that it continues to build, and it is in the big cities, which there are many of. And I'm going to be watching this very closely.
We're out of time.
But. Okay, but as our politician in residence here, you know that the big challenge is to do the organizing without waking up the base, the other base.
Yes.
Well, that's the thing. In the governor's race, it's still leaning Republican, so...
All right. We are out of time. In fact, we're late. So thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.